In our upcoming book, Signal, there's a case that I think captures the entire problem with how testosterone is getting handled right now. A guy named Mark, he's 45 years old, he's a partner at an architectural firm, and he's used to 12-hour days where he's normally sharp and productive. But over about a year, all of that goes away. The focus is gone. The energy is gone. His marriage is suffering. So he does what a lot of guys would do. He finds a wellness clinic online, and they draw his blood. 2 days later, the number comes back. Total testosterone is 240 nanograms per deciliter. To Mark, that number is an explanation. It's a reason for everything that has been going wrong. So the clinic starts him on weekly testosterone injections. And for a few weeks, he feels something. But by month three, the fatigue is worse than it was before he started. He's waking up with headaches, and his blood pressure is climbing. The problem was never his testosterone. The clinic treated the number rather than treating the patient. Over the next four episodes, we're going to show you why, what testosterone actually is, how to tell when it's genuinely low, what is driving the numbers down at the population level, and what the evidence says you can do about it. All of that comes from our upcoming book, Signal. This week, is the testosterone crisis that you keep hearing about actually real? I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, and this is the Barbell Medicine Podcast. And help me sort the signal from the noise on testosterone. It's the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baracchi. What's going on, man?
Feeling good. Had a decent bench session this morning, and I suspect my acute post-workout testosterone spike is riding high. So let's get into it.
If it was in the last 30 minutes, that is correct. Some acute post-workout testosteronemia likely present, although ultimately unimportant.
Agree.
So let's get into this. Yeah, we're talking about testosterone today, and to start, I want to talk about the prescription issue, the prescription problem, if you will. About a quarter of men who start testosterone have never had their blood tested prior to starting testosterone replacement therapy, or TRT. And that's the starting point. It just gets worse from there. So this is from a 2015 study in JAMA. They found that 25% of new testosterone prescriptions in the United States are written without a preceding blood test. Now, this data is from the 2001 to 2011 window. The prescribing landscape has gotten more aggressive from there and likely worse. Mostly the way it's gotten worse is by using the sort of wellness clinic model. There is a relatively brief, often online or in an app intake, a single blood draw potentially, and then a prescription. There's a financial incentive here, obviously, because the people are actively seeking testosterone prescriptions and people are happy to give it, not necessarily a diagnosis. To that end, testosterone prescriptions have nearly quadrupled in the last 20 years, with an estimated 3 to 4 million men now taking prescription testosterone. So yeah, a quarter of the time, the decision to put somebody on a hormone for potentially the rest of their life is made without confirming that the hormone is actually low in the first place. And again, it gets worse after that. In the year after the prescription testosterone started, nearly half don't have a single lab draw to confirm that their testosterone levels are within the correct range. So the prescribing system is broken. But what about guys who are trying to handle it themselves using supplements? That's the second problem here. The supplements, by and large, don't work. A 2018 JAMA study found that 62% of testosterone booster supplements have zero published data supporting their claims. 10% of these supplements marketed to increase testosterone actually had data showing that their ingredients decreased testosterone. And there's a contamination issue too. A 2020 review of over 50 products in this segment showed that 18% showed no effect. The ones that had positive data were modest, inconsistent, and clinically insignificant, and 12% of them were adulterated or had undisclosed synthetic steroids. Now, that's going to work, Austin. Like, if you see a person and they're like, I'm not taking anything, doc, just this, you know, these supplements, and it's maybe got an aggressive sounding name, and then they happen to want a testosterone level just to check. And you're like, all right, look, you want it. I've discussed this with you. And now their testosterone level is 1500 nanograms per deciliter. What goes through your mind?
Yeah, totally. That the contamination issue is real. And when you say that they can contain undisclosed steroids, sometimes it's straight up anabolic steroids that they might be taking without realizing it. Sometimes it's actually, unfortunately, like the catabolic kind of steroids like prednisone or methylprednisolone or something like that, that can make people feel actually good. And so I've actually seen cases where people ended up with essentially giving themselves Cushing syndrome as a result of taking supplements that they were like, oh, this makes my joints feel amazing. And it's like, yeah, you're taking like a very potent anti-inflammatory medicine. And then when they stop it, they maybe have some adrenal insufficiency or other things. So the contamination issue, whether with anabolic or even catabolic steroids, is definitely a real thing. Have seen it in practice numerous times.
Yeah. Sometimes when people are like, this supplement works to do X, whether it's sleep, whether it's, you know, muscle gain, sexual function, or whatever, my first instinct is kind of like, does it contain the actual pharmaceutical that we know does this?
Yeah, exactly.
Which often is the case in those particular categories. They tend to be relatively high rates of contamination in those categories. So yeah, if you take a natural testosterone booster spiked with actual androgens or steroids, and the brain detects that the outside source of testosterone is there, it'll shut down your own production. So you could actually end up, you know, getting this sort of hypogonadism or testosterone deficiency induced by a supplement you were taking in the first place to increase it, which is kind of odd. One of these, and the more famous ones recently, has been D-aspartic acid. It's marketed as this sort of natural testosterone booster, even though three independent studies found no benefit. And one found that taking 6 grams per day significantly decreased both total and free testosterone. A test booster that lowers testosterone is a bit ironic to me. And the ZMA story is also worth telling. ZMA stands for zinc magnesium aspartate. This was marketed heavily as a testosterone and recovery supplement, sometimes for sleep. The only positive study on the supplement was co-authored by the patent holder, Victor Conti, who you might remember from Balco Lab and Barry Bonds.
Great story. Yes.
He later served prison time for distributing these designer steroids to elite athletes, as most people know. And every independent replication of that study found either no effect on testosterone in men, as long as they had normal zinc levels. So that was the kind of differentiating factor there. Sidebar, he was also a bassist in the musical group Tower of Power in the 1970s. So the musician, a steroid distributor pipeline is well established. We all know that. I think it's.
Yeah. For those who are unfamiliar, I'm pretty sure that the Balco Victor Conti story was told in, it might've been in a whole podcast season of the American Scandal podcast. We have no affiliation with them, but that's a great, you know, storytelling podcast. And then I seem to remember reading another book about this whole saga, which was just kind of fascinating, back then, between his relationship with Barry Bonds, allegedly, as well as many like Olympians and things like that. So yeah, for anyone, that would be an interesting sports history story to dig into.
I think there was an ESPN 30 for 30 on that, or like E60 on it or something.
I wouldn't be surprised
if there was no like other coverage of this, but I mean, when you think about like the only positive study of this particular supplement was from the guy who patented it and then also later served jail time for synthetic steroid distribution. Yeah, that does raise some red flags. So Austin, when you see a patient who is on one of these testosterone booster supplements, what is your first concern? You kind of alluded to this contamination risk, but is there anything else that pops up?
Yeah, the main thing is going to be the safety aspect, because my baseline kind of supposition up front, assuming that they're not actually taking anabolic steroids, is that the efficacy is unlikely to be present, meaning that my baseline expectation is that this probably isn't helping. And so then the question is it likely to be harming, or mm-hmm. could it be interacting with something else they're taking, or, you know, whatever the case is. And so I'm not coming into this, you know, on the attack when I have conversations with patients about this, but rather like, tell me what led to this decision. How are you obtaining this? How are you using it? Is it something obviously that you're like injecting, which comes with additional potential risks, depending on whether you know what you're doing on that front? You know, what's your sourcing, things like that. And then getting a sense of, well, what are your goals in using this? And maybe their goals are something that can be achieved in a better, safer, and even more effective way. So perhaps this person just has fatigue and it's like, oh, nobody ever checked or talked to them about their sleep. And it turns out that they're treating their untreated sleep apnea with Chinese bathtub, you know, anabolic steroids or something like that, right? So getting a sense of what led the person to make this decision and what are they trying to accomplish, so that we can do essentially like some combination of harm reduction and then actual effective treatment. That's my usual approach in these situations.
Yeah. I remember I had a patient back during intern year, and they were very interested in starting testosterone, not for TRT related purposes, but mostly for enhancement,
just
right?
Straight up getting on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the conversation was exactly as you kind of mentioned. It's like, what are your goals of taking this, mm-hmm. you know? Because if somebody was taking it to treat something else, then there's a clear sort of you know, bifurcation or whatever of your sort of patient interaction. Like, okay, cool. Well, we can work that up. We can see if there's actually something else that's causing this to make sure we're doing the right thing here. Or if the person's like, actually nothing's wrong, I just want to gain a bunch of muscle and get real, real strong. And you're like, well, that would be one way to do it, obviously, to support the training aspect of it. And so, yeah, what do you think about this sort of, you know, you want to build this therapeutic alliance with the patient. They came in with a specific question, which, you know, you're here to address. You don't want to just say, nah, don't do it. And then, you know, kick them out. Right. So how do you address that if someone just wants to take this from like a performance standpoint?
Yeah, I'm somebody who tries not to be extremely paternalistic in these types of conversations of just like, no, get out of my office, because that ends up being a scenario where it's like, if I can tell this person is, you know, going to get their hands on the stuff no matter what, then they may end up in a situation where they are doing it either in a very overtly unsafe way or without any monitoring or something like that. And so really, I think after enough years doing this and having all sorts of conversations with patients, you get a sense of, you know, the idea of shared decision making is a controversial one, because some and informed consent and things like that, because a lot of folks dispute the idea of like, can patients ever be fully informed and do this shared decision making when you're just like fundamentally maybe not on exactly the same level? I would dispute that in some cases and say sometimes the physician is actually the less informed one on certain issues compared with the patient. I see that a lot, for example, in my common now hobby horse of iron deficiency, seeing all these women with ferritins of 10 and their doctor's like, well, you're not anemic, so you don't need anything. And I just get enraged by that. But in this situation, if I can tell that this person has a specific goal they're trying to accomplish, has a clear sense of like, okay, this is for sure not medically indicated. Like, they do not have clinical testosterone deficiency. They understand that. They are deliberately choosing to pursue a route that leads to them achieving, you know, super physiologic levels for that goal. And they're seeking guidance on like safety and monitoring along the way and things like that. And it's like, okay, we'll call it like a harm reduction method. Now, obviously, this is not going to be something that insurance is going to cover your course of anabolics for, right? But if you're doing it anyway, I would rather you do it in a way that is safer, potentially with some form of guidance and monitoring, compared with, you know, doing it, you know, going off in left field and doing it on your own, potentially with no monitoring at all. So I'm pretty open with having these conversations with folks and guiding them, as long as it's clear of like, this is not a clear medical indication. We're off the reservation here. You understand what the potential risks are compared with the potential benefits that are not really benefits for most people, but you are choosing to place value on these benefits. And so you're choosing to move forward regardless of what I tell you. Okay, well, maybe I can, you know, have some impact on helping this be safer rather than more risky.
Yeah, that argument or line of thinking rather comes up often when talking about the doping and sport sort of angle, you know, that athletes are going to use anyway, at least some athletes, right? The current policies and testing and penalties do not apparently dissuade use mm-hmm. to a significant level. And so if this is really about athlete safety, perhaps a different set of policies should be enacted, you know, as far as guidance, monitoring, limits, you know, whatever. Oh, that's another topic perhaps.
Yeah. And there is a difference when people come in, if they're have like genuine uncertainty and asking for your advice and recommendation, versus they're like, look, I'm going to do this. And so I need some advice given that I'm going to do this, right? Somebody comes in and they're like, should I do this? And I'm probably going to say, no, I wouldn't, you know, recommend it from a health, longevity, medical, you know, advisability standpoint. But if they're like, I'm doing this, what do you think? And I'm like, okay, well, we can go about it in the safer way or the less safe way. And let me nudge you towards the former.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. We talked about the prescription without labs problem. We talked about supplements that don't work when people try to kind of self-medicate. And now a third issue, the lab test itself. So the first thing you should know is that roughly half of men with an initially low testosterone level will come back normal on repeat testing. That's like one night of bad sleep, having a stressful week, a recent illness, the number will go down. But if you repeat the test the next week, it'll be normal. That's why you need two tests. Now, what we see from the Massachusetts Male Aging Study, this is a study with over 1,700 men in the Boston area. They were tracked over time. Among men meeting criteria for testosterone deficiency at their first check-in, over 50% had normal levels at follow-up without any treatment. The system is often self-correcting. So a single low value is a snapshot of a moment, is not necessarily a diagnosis. And the natural sort of recovery rate or bounce back rate kind of depends on health status here. Leaner men, so those with less body fat, tend to have a higher probability of natural recovery. But for men with significant obesity and or chronic illness, the suppression often becomes a sort of persistent state that the body cannot resolve on its own. And so then in that case, you kind of go down the pathway of starting medication. So we have a quarter of prescriptions that are written without labs. The supplement market is mostly empty promises spiked with real problems, potentially. And the lab test itself is unreliable enough that half of low results normalize on their own. That's the landscape. And the people getting caught in it are guys who are genuinely struggling with something real, but are not getting the evaluation they need and deserve. So Austin, when a guy comes to you and says that his testosterone is low, what is the first thing that you want to know before you even look at the number?
Yeah, this is actually something that is more surprisingly common, that people come in leading with the number. And I think to your point about the test itself, people do view like this black and white number on the page or on their, you know, PDF as a pretty like static immutable thing of like, that's just what my level is, without really being able to detect or have an understanding of just how dynamic this system is. Now, I imagine like if you could, not that I'm saying by any means that this would be wise, but if you could have some kind of mobile telemetry, like you have an Apple Watch that tracks your heart rate and it was tracking this hormone level, you would be shocked at the fluctuations, just like people would probably be shocked by their blood pressure or all sorts of other kind of physiologic parameters. And for, this is not exclusive to testosterone, even other hormone issues that can spontaneously resolve. So people can have legitimate hypothyroidism that goes into remission, that gets better on its own, right? A fraction of people that will happen to without the need for long-term hormone replacement therapy and things like that. So this is not a unique scenario here. So if somebody comes in and their initial concern is, look, my number's low, my first question is always going to be, can you tell me a little bit about the context that led you to get this lab test done? Because the possibilities are, I'm feeling great, doing great, training's going well, no complaints, but I got some labs checked just because I wanted to know, and the number is low. So then, of course, I'll look at the number and try to get a sense of, is it like truly clinically low, or is it more likely in those types of situations, perhaps lower than the person would like for it to be, or lower than they have had some expectation set that it should be, maybe at their age or something like that. And that leads to a different type of conversation. If it is alarmingly clinically low, even if they're telling me they're feeling well, so their level is, I don't know, 100 or something like that, I've got some questions. My first question is about, again, the accuracy of that test. And it's something that probably would lead to getting repeated in that situation, because there are some things that can lead to that happening. But the main thing that I'm most interested in is, what were the sets of symptoms, and if there are any clinical signs that led the person to get that test done, because that's what helps me to contextualize this, to assess what's the probability of clinical testosterone deficiency. And then from there, that would lead to subsequent diagnostic evaluation, even before we get to the stage of initiating, like, you know, hormone treatment or something like that, because there are still yet other things that may need to be evaluated or that could be offered that may mitigate the need for long-term hormone therapy and things like that. So there are still numerous steps that would need to be done before getting to that step that you started out with, where people are getting started on therapy without even getting the level checked at all, much less the necessary subsequent evaluation, because this can be problematic depending on where in the physiologic axis the problem, quote unquote, lives. If they have a pituitary disease, right, just putting them on testosterone may be actually woefully insufficient compared with all of the things that they might need to have done. Or if they have testicular failure, like there are a lot of other considerations that need to go into that before you can, just treat somebody with just the hormone itself. So to summarize, like if they're just here, my number's low, it's like, how low? And what signs and symptoms led it to get checked in the first place? Those are probably the first couple questions that I'm wanting to get a sense of.
Yeah. In addition to like, when was the lab drawn, time of day, make sure it's done appropriately. So the number itself, if you're even considering it, or when you are considering it, is reliable enough to actually take into consideration. So that's the current landscape: a broken system selling solutions to a problem that it hasn't properly defined. There's another layer to this, and you've probably seen the headlines. Testosterone levels are declining. Every successive generation has less than the one before. If that's true, that changes the conversation. When we come back from the break, we will look at the data and figure out how much of it is actually real. If you've been dealing with a nagging injury, if you just came out of surgery, or you work with people who have, I want to tell you about our upcoming pain and rehab seminar in Bozeman, Montana, June 20th and 21st. This is a two-day deep dive into how we actually think about pain, rehab, and getting people back to exercise. We've updated the curriculum this year to reflect where the evidence is right now, with training lectures covering the current recommendations for exercise during injury and rehab, and breakout sessions on exercise modifications and technique tailored to specific individuals. This isn't just a powerlifting-focused event. The modifications content has been expanded to cover athletes across different sports. So wherever you're meeting your current patients or clients, there's going to be something you can put directly into practice. For example, the lower extremity post-op lecture and its subsequent breakout walks through the full rehab spectrum after surgery, with a strong emphasis on the middle phase of training. This is the phase that gets the least attention and causes the most problems. We spend real time on the return to sport criteria and how to structure progressions that actually get somebody there. The pain lecture also has new cases this year and is built around helping folks make sense of what they're experiencing. Not just here's what the research says, but how to use that information in a real conversation with a real person who's frustrated and confused and wants to know what to do next. Spots are limited, so if you want to learn more and register today, head over to barbellmedicine.com and look for the Bozeman Pain and Rehab Seminar. We also have a link in the show notes below. All right, we are back here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Before the break, we looked at how broken the system around testosterone is right now. A quarter of men start treatment without ever getting their blood tested. Most supplements have no data or are outright contaminated. And the lab test itself, it normalizes on its own about half the time. And now for the second headline. Testosterone levels are declining. Every generation has less testosterone than the one before it. There's usually a YouTube thumbnail attached that implies civilization is also ending. Now look, the decline is probably real, but the size of it has been overstated, and the cause of it is a lot less mysterious than the coverage wants it to be. Here's where that headline comes from. It's the Massachusetts Male Aging Study. They followed roughly 1,700 men from the Boston area over time. They tested two different birth cohorts. These are groups of men at the same age who were born 15 years apart. The younger cohort had testosterone levels between 15 and 20% lower than the older one, even after adjusting for health factors, including obesity. Studies from Finland and Israel found similar patterns. That's three independent groups, three different countries, each using the same type of test throughout their study. The same finding emerging independently carries some weight. These are studies behind the commonly cited figure, approximately a 1% year decline in testosterone at the level of the population. A few problems, though. Those studies were small, they used older testing methods, and the most recent data they included is nearly 20 years old. So what happens when somebody finally does this at scale with up-to-date data? A 2025 meta-analysis pooled more than 1,200 studies with over 1 million subjects spanning from 1971 to 2024. The decline they found was approximately 0.56% per year, half of what the headline normally reads. There's one more finding from that meta-analysis that matters. When they broke the studies down by testing method, the studies using mass spec, the most accurate test available, it showed no significant decline at all. The authors attributed this to a shortened surveillance period, only 30 years of mass spec data versus 50 years of data overall. But if the decline were truly around 0.3% per year, a conservative estimate based on this study, and we have high quality data on more than 100,000 subjects across 30 years, which the study did, that should be more than enough to detect the predicted 9% cumulative drop. The most accurate test in the largest available sample found nothing. So the real decline in population testosterone is probably closer to 0.3 to 0.4% per year, which brings up two questions. Why is the commonly reported number so much higher, and why is testosterone going down in the first place? The commonly cited 1% per year is a mixture of three things: a modest biological decline, fat that BMI can't measure, being labeled as an unexplained cause, and testing artifacts from comparing two different rulers across eras. Let's walk through each one. First, the test changed. Most testosterone research through the mid-2000s used immunoassays. Now, immunoassays don't actually measure testosterone directly. They infer the concentration of testosterone by measuring how much of a labeled decoy molecule gets displaced from an antibody. The problem is that other steroids, like estradiol, a type of estrogen, DHT and DHEA, among others, displace this decoy too. This is called cross-reactivity, and it means that immunoassays systematically overstate testosterone levels, especially at low concentrations. At low levels, the overestimation is large enough to push a genuinely deficient man above the diagnostic threshold. He looks normal on paper when he's really not. Now, labs started switching to mass spec in the late 2000s. It identifies testosterone by exact molecular weight. It's more accurate and it has less noise. When researchers retested stored blood samples from men previously measured by immunoassay, the proportion of those falling below 300 nanograms per deciliter nearly doubled. The older tests had been overstating it. The Endocrine Society responded by revising the lower limit of normal from 300 to 264. The threshold dropped because the test got better, not really because the men got any worse. So across the last 50 years, the older immunoassay values read high and the newer mass spec values read accurately. If you compare them side by side, part of the decline is just two different rulers measuring the same thing. So Austin, when you're looking at testosterone research and the study used an immunoassay, how much does that change how you read the result?
I think that this is something that points to just a broader issue in like research interpretation when you are a practicing clinician. And the point that I'm getting at is the applicability or the generalizability of a study to the context where you're going to be potentially using or applying the result. Now, I am not a analytical chemist, although having dabbled in a little bit of it in my undergrad studies, and I certainly rely on a lot of laboratory medicine in practice, doing and interpreting labs, and requires to some extent having an awareness of their limitations and caveats and problems that I run into all the time with labs that I might order in a hospitalized patient or in an outpatient. How much do I trust this result? There are various things that can make a blood sodium level falsely low. It can make an A1C falsely high. And that's stuff that requires a lot of dedicated, deliberate training and experience to be able to interpret and apply accurately. And so I will admit, you know, earlier on in my career, not having a great sense of this knowledge base around immunoassay versus mass spec as it relates to the reliability of your testosterone levels. That's not something that I was very, very in tune with very early on. But since becoming more aware of these things, it has impacted, again, the generalizability of a given, you know, piece of research to the patient in front of me. And it has also made me more attentive to the test that I'm ordering on a patient. So for example, if now when I'm ordering these tests on folks and they're going to go get it done at a lab, I am somewhat deliberate in either how I order it or once I see the result or wanting to know what type of assay this lab uses. Because again, there are these limitations. There are the kind of very older analog assays versus some of these immunoassays versus the modern, you know, mass spec. And you people who have listened to us talk about this or others might have heard of, like, you know, this equilibrium dialysis methods and various fancy things that have different pros and cons, both in terms of accuracy and cost and things like that. So really, it's just a matter of like, how applicable is this result that I'm seeing in this research paper to the patient in front of me or their test result? So if I have, you know, an older research paper that is run using older immunoassays, and yet I'm trying to apply it to a patient in front of me using a mass spec result, I might have to be a bit more cautious. It doesn't mean it's completely useless, but it doesn't mean that I should just mindlessly, you know, apply one data set to a different context without being a bit more critical about it.
Yeah, I think overall for the listeners at home, it's like when you're considering this decline that we've seen at the population level, and it's been quoted at 1% per year for 20 years or more, at least half of that is due to the lab tests changing in the data sets that we currently have. When we restrict the analysis to just the quote good lab test, the one that's relatively accurate, that decline almost disappears. It's at least half, perhaps less than what's originally stated, which kind of brings up the next question. Well, all right, look, if that's just half of the explained drop, well, what's the proportion? What's the cause of the other half? And I think that problem is another measurement issue that these studies, when they're, quote, correcting for obesity, they're using BMI, which unfortunately misses a lot. The problem with BMI, and we've stated this on this podcast in many different ways, many different contexts, is that it both systematically underdiagnoses obesity, meaning that it misses a lot of people who are carrying too much body fat, but who do not have a BMI over 30, misses about half of men, for example. And it also doesn't tell you where the fat is. So for example, a person could have too much fat that BMI just missed, period. And that fat could be surrounding their organs, called this visceral adipose tissue. So all three of these major, quote, secular decline studies adjusted for obesity using BMI. And as we know, BMI measures body weight relative to height, but it does not distinguish fat from muscle. It does not distinguish visceral fat from subcutaneous fat under your skin. And that visceral fat is hormonally active. We call this VAT, which stands for visceral adipose tissue. Again, that's fat packed around your organs. And this fat contains the enzyme aromatase, which drives testosterone lower. BMI doesn't correct for that at all. And as we mentioned, since it does misclassify about 50% of individuals as non-obese, we get come up with that number by comparing BMI to DEXA scanning, which is much more accurate for not only telling you how much body fat the person has, but also where it is. So BMI performs worse also at the lower end of obesity, where many men with excess visceral fat register below 30. They might be 28 or 29, might be carrying too much body fat. BMI does pretty poorly there. Now, why this matters is because visceral adipose tissue, or VAT, those levels have been going up much faster than BMI over the same time frame that we've seen this apparent decline. Men at a given BMI had measurably larger waists in 2000 than compared to 1988. Generation X carries significantly more abdominal fat than baby boomers at the same age. Men have been gaining abdominal fat faster than overall weight. The same BMI reading represented more visceral fat in 2010 than it did in 1985. We also see a decline in muscle because grip strength has also declined across birth cohorts in multiple westernized countries after adjusting for height, suggesting that muscle mass is declining and fat mass is increasing at any given weight across the generations. So all of this taken together, to me, suggests that, look, you can't use BMI alone because it's missing visceral adipose tissue. And even if BMI has stayed stable, people are still getting fatter within that same BMI range. So it is insufficient. So the three studies adjusting for obesity using BMI and finding the same residual decline in testosterone levels are all making the same error here. They're calling the decline unexplained because their instrument can't measure the very thing that explains it. So the tests overstated testosterone in older studies, and BMI could not see the visceral fat that suppresses it. What happens when you fix both problems at once? There's a really elegant study done by Nianti, who used archive blood samples from 1988 to 1991, and then a second set of archive blood samples from 1999 to 2004, right? So spread out just about a decade. They used the same test in the same laboratory at the same time, which removes any possibility that calibration drift of the testing platform contributed to the difference in levels. But they also added a waist circumference, the venerable waist circumference, to alongside BMI to model for obesity. Now, after adjusting for age, race, BMI, waist circumference, and lifestyle factors, there was no significant decline in total or free testosterone. So that corroborates the data from the largest meta-analysis that we have as well, using the best test that is available. When we fix the testing artifact and we measure the body fat properly, this sort of secular decline disappears in a nationally representative sample. So Austin, as a doctor, when you see a study design like that, same lab, same testing platform, and they added waist circumference and the decline suddenly vanishes, what does that tell you?
Yeah, I think you did an excellent job with your homework and analysis here. And I think that the result of this study, really the main effect is going to be to upset people whose preferred narrative is the decline of men or the decline of Western civilization, or here's my supplement stack that will serve to restore your testosterone levels because, you know, men these days aren't what they used to be. That's probably the main take home is people who prefer that narrative explanation might be a little bit upset to find out that maybe it's quite a lot simpler than that. The tests have gotten better, and that is a big part of the result vanishing. And then the rest is excess visceral body fat that is well known and well characterized to have harmful effects on all sorts of things, including on this testosterone axis.
Yeah, I think that's the best explanation to me as well. If we consider this sort of like base, you know, assumption that testosterone levels have been going down 1% per year for 20 years, all right, half of that is due to the testing issue. And the other half, or at least most of that other half, is due to the expansion in obesity. The rest, whatever's left over, to me, is likely noise, you know, and not terribly concerning from a clinical standpoint. That's the way I think about it. And if you really want to blow your own mind, just go look at testosterone data from the last 10 years, right? So not necessarily 2026. I think the data ends 2023 or 2024, but the last 10 years of testosterone average level data in the United States actually shows an increase in the United States. And so imagine that headline.
Right.
You know, instead of testosterone levels are going down, men aren't what they used to. If instead it said,
thanks, RFK.
Testosterone levels are going up. Must be the beef tallow.
Right. Yeah. And none of this is to say that, you know, testosterone deficiency is not a potentially real thing that somebody might experience, or that they might have that clinical scenario where they actually stand to benefit from treatment, but rather this just like wholesale population wide, you know, worldwide decline that is this emergency that we need to search for this, you know, root cause. It's like, okay, it's actually a lot less complicated than you're making it out to be. And so by using appropriate testing methods and then accounting for the general trends that we're already observing with respect to obesity and cardiometabolic disease, we can explain a lot of this. And that also helps us to direct our attention towards the most effective interventions to address this issue to the extent that it is real on a population level. Of course, you know, when you have a single patient sitting in front of you with a particular set of signs and symptoms and lab tests, I'm much less concerned with population-wide trends. I'm just like looking at that person. But to the extent that this, you know, population level claims have caused such hysteria in the media and things like that, then I think that this is a good analysis to address that.
So what does all this mean? The decline is probably real at the population level, but it's probably not unexplained. It's in fact pretty obvious that lab testing has contributed and the increase in body fat has also contributed. And whatever's left over is likely too small to detect reliably with any available data set. The higher figures, 1% per year, testosterone crisis, civilization ending, reflect a mixture of genuine biological decline, fat that BMI has failed to measure, and testing artifacts. The actual rate after accounting for these is probably much lower. Now, longitudinal data shows that men who remain lean, active, and free of chronic disease exhibit stability in their testosterone levels. It doesn't really drop well into their 70s and 80s, which again is a counterfactual that most people either have never heard before or maybe don't believe based on the sort of priming from all of this other stuff. The decline is not necessarily destiny. It's not going to happen automatically, but it does tend to track with metabolic health rather than your birth year. So Austin, when a patient comes in worried that his generation is losing testosterone and perhaps just wants you to check because of that, how do you frame this? How do you go about this conversation?
Yeah. Fortunately, this is not a situation that I have actually had to deal with where their primary concern when coming in is for the broader generation. But I can see how that could happen to where they've maybe heard this or seen this headline and they get worried and want to check. And so really fundamentally, I'm doing the same sort of general health assessment that I would on anybody else. How are they feeling? How are they functioning? Are they sleeping? Are they exercising? What's their body composition looking like? Blood pressure, blood lipids, cardiovascular risk, all those sorts of things. And then what are their goals? And sometimes, you know, I do end up getting to points in these conversations where even if things are all looking okay, the person is just like adamant and they really just want to get their test done. And again, I'm to be blunt, I don't care enough to be like a rigid paternalistic gatekeeper around this information, but rather I try to like get the person on board with the idea of like, we do tests in a way that should be hopefully informative to what our subsequent steps are going to be. So let's like role play this scenario out a little bit. Let's say that you do this test and it comes back at this number. What are we going to do? Let's say it comes back at this number. What are we going to do? Let's say it comes back at this number. What are we going to do? And if we end up in a scenario where the answer to all three of those things is the same, sometimes patients are like, okay, I'll skip it. Not worth my time. And they kind of come to that realization in real time during the conversation. Other times they still want to get it done. Like, okay, fine. It's your health information. I'm not here to like gatekeep it from you. That doesn't mean that I'm going to like recommend treating, you know, on the back end if it's a solidly normal number or something like that. So that's the way I would have that conversation, is assessing like, where is this concern coming from? Maybe gently, if they're open to having the conversation, pushing back a little bit on probably some inaccurate ideas about, you know, whether that generational decline is so precipitous, and then really just focusing instead of on the generation or the media or the headlines, on like them, their health, their goals, their priorities, and how we can best support those.
Yeah. Well said. Again, focusing on the patient rather than like this narrative that's been built. Although again, that narrative is hard to ignore if it's been beaten into you. Mm-hmm. So to summarize, the secular decline is real, but it's modest, probably about 0.3 to 0.4% per year, which is mostly explained by rising obesity and testing artifacts, not a mysterious generational collapse. So here's what we're left with: a prescribing system where a quarter of men start testosterone without ever confirming that it's low, a supplement market where the majority of products have no supporting data, and 1 in 8 muscle building products is contaminated with undisclosed steroids, a lab test where half of the low results normalize on their own, and a headline about declining testosterone that is mostly explained by rising obesity and the fact that we changed how we measured it. The system around testosterone is not serving the people that it's supposed to help. The guys who are genuinely struggling with fatigue, brain fog, with a sex drive that disappeared, with a body that doesn't respond the way it used to, those guys deserve better than a wellness clinic that treats a number without asking what produced it. They deserve better than a supplement aisle full of empty promises. And they deserve better than a single blood draw at 3 in the afternoon that becomes a lifelong prescription. That's why we wrote Signal, and that's what this series is all about. Before we close, 5 things to take with you this week. 1, a single low testosterone level is not a diagnosis. Roughly half of initially low values will normalize on repeat testing. A snapshot isn't a pattern. 2, the supplement market for testosterone is largely unsupported by evidence. 62% of products have 0 published data. 12% of muscle-building supplements are contaminated with undisclosed steroids that can actually shut down your natural production. 3, the secular decline in testosterone is real but modest, about 0.3 to 0.4% per year, after you account for the testing artifacts and the fat that BMI couldn't measure. When you fix both problems, the decline disappears in nationally representative data. 4, the decline tracks with metabolic health, not your birth year. Men who stay lean, active, and free of chronic disease maintain stable testosterone well into their 70s and 80s. 5, if you're concerned about your testosterone, the first step is not a clinic, not a supplement, and not a single blood draw. The first step is understanding how the system actually works and what real evaluation looks like. Next week on the podcast, how testosterone actually works, the feedback loop that produces it, what the number on your lab report really means. It's the concept from our book that I think changes how most people think about this hormone and what a real diagnosis of testosterone deficiency requires. Episode 2 of 4 in our Signal book launch series. Everything we talked about today and everything that we'll cover over the next 3 weeks comes from our upcoming book, Signal. It's the complete picture, the history, the physiology, the diagnosis, the lifestyle interventions, and the treatment protocols. If this series is useful, the book goes deeper on every topic. Signal's coming soon. Link in the show notes and at barbellmedicine.com. If this episode was useful, leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It's the single best thing you can do so we can keep bringing you all of this nuance in health and fitness. I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. That's Dr. Austin Baraki. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.